The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Master Wu Men's Gateless Gate, case 39. Yunmen says you've missed it, the main case. A student once wanted to ask Master Yunmen a question and started to say, "The light serenely shines over the whole universe." Before she'd even finished the first line, Yunmen suddenly interrupted. "Isn't that the poem of Chang Cho?" The student answered, "Yes, it is." Yunmen said, "You've missed it." Later, another master took up this koan and said, "Now tell me, why has this student missed it?" The commentary. In this koan, if you can grasp how lofty and unapproachable Yunmen's Zen working is, and why the student missed it, then you can be a teacher in heaven and on earth. In case you are not yet clear about it, you will be unable to save even yourself. The verse. A line is dropped in a swift stream. Greedy for the bait, she's caught. If you open your mouth only a little, your life is lost. So this weekend we have been, with many of you, conducting an introductory retreat. And the koan is an aspect of Zen teaching and training. It's a way of taking up meditation. And so there, in Buddhism, there are many different practices of meditation. We begin, generally, everyone begins practicing the breath and practices that in some different ways as it evolves. The koan is a kind of extraordinary way of merging the conceptual and non-conceptual. Language and meaning, which is usually quite a trap for us. We get very caught in words and language. But it's employing that language, words with particular meaning, that the student takes in and brings into their meditation in such a way that they don't actively think about it. It's not a contemplative practice. They're sitting with the koan in such a way that the words and the meaning enter into a deeper realm in their consciousness. And when it merges everything, when the student and the koan, the question and the insight, when all of that comes into one whole, complete moment, then there is an insight, there's understanding. And so the koans, in a sense, or how to ask a ultimate question, a question that isn't maybe asked in words and language, but can't be answered that way. Buddhism is a path of inquiry, a path of examination. It takes up the question of life and death, living and dying, of suffering and the liberation from suffering, of mind, of self and other. And it's a deeply personal practice because it's happening, dukkha happens within us. It's something we experience, suffering. We then export it, right? We give it out. And so other people experience our dukkha as we are experiencing theirs, and it becomes one, as the Buddha might have said, one whole mass of suffering. But the Buddha realized, because it's something we are actively doing, that it can cease, it can come to rest. And that must come from deep within the heart. Bodhicitta is the arising of the aspiration in those moments when going along with the ordinary current of life is no longer sufficient. And so in the beginning, we have to get to a point where we no longer are willing to accept samsara as the only possibility. And then in entering into practice, we have to then turn around and begin accepting samsara. We have to accept what seems unacceptable, but now in a new way. Before, when we accepted it, when we just sort of act out of it, play out of it, believe in it, hope it will work, that's generally without examination. When we begin practicing, and now we have to accept all the different ways that samsara arises, because otherwise we can't practice. We can't examine. We can't get close. But that acceptance is now happening within that examination. It's happening within a mind that is being tuned through meditation into mindfulness. So now that it can actually see, it has come closer. And then ultimately, we have to go beyond accepting or not accepting, because both of those are still impermanent. When we look out, we see colors and hear sounds and observe histories. We see disagreements. We get involved in them. We see challenges, small and large. Turning in, what do you see? Many people understand on some level, it's sort of a common thing with spiritual practice that we need to turn in. But what does that actually mean? Where are you turning to? Where is this in that you're turning? And then what are you to do in turning in? How are we to understand what we experience when we turn in? It's important because all the world arises from this. And in a time where there are experts abounding with opinions on everything, when there are spiritual teachers of old traditions, of new traditions, of no traditions at all, when from so many corners there are promises, how do we know what's a true path? How do you know what is a true path? And then how do you know if it's true for you? Where do you find yourself? Tricycle some time ago did an article on spiritual but not religious. I imagine there are also many who are religious but not necessarily spiritual. And there are those who are not interested in either. Somebody asked during the weekend, is Buddhism a religion? And I realized I never actually responded to that question. In a sense, what would you like it to be? If it helps you to think of it as a religion, it's a religion. If that gets in your way, then it's definitely not a religion. And that what I mean by that is that Buddhism isn't something definable. It is not a thing. And so however we frame it in our mind is just that. It's just a temporary way of framing that may be helpful. And so we have to have faith. We talked about that a little bit during the weekend. And we have to inquire. We have to examine. And those work together. That it's the inquiry that keeps the faith from just becoming a kind of blind obedience. Because we are examining. We're questioning. We're testing. We're seeing for ourselves whether this is true. When we come into practice or encounter the Dharma, we encounter a lot about attachments and how attachments is the source of suffering. Is that actually true? Do you know that? We need to know that for sure and see whether that's true. And so here in this koan, Master Yunmen, who was one of the great sort of luminous teachers in the Chan tradition, Chinese Chan, was once asked a question by a student. And the student wanted to ask a question and started by saying, the light serenely shines over the whole universe. And Yunmen interrupted her and said, isn't that a poem by Chang Cho? And she said, yes, it is. And Yunmen said, you've missed it. The light serenely shines over the whole universe. Ignorant, wise, and living creatures are all in my abode. Why does Buddhism focus so deeply on mind? The examination of mind, the nature of mind, the appearance of mind, the many forms of mind. The Buddha realized that the nature of mind is clear and bright and luminous. It's clear because it's without any imperfection. It's bright because it's lucid and sharp and awake and seen, and it's luminous because it illuminates everything that comes within its radiance. It reveals things as they are. That's why when we sit, we're cultivating, we're sitting to bring forth that mind, which is already present because it never disappears. It's not a thing. It's unborn and undying. And yet, because of our attachments, because of our false views, because of our entrenched habit patterns, it can appear to us as very dim and dull. Or it can appear as very excited and agitated. And so we sit and very clearly are trying to work with those two sort of habit patterns. And so the penchant that we have, the tendency in meditation for the mind to go towards dullness, towards complacency, towards a kind of opaqueness. And so then we have to brighten our awareness, sharpen it, bring it into aliveness. And that's something we have to discover how to do. And we do that within whatever form of Zazen we're practicing, if it's the breath, if it's Shikantaza. We bring that mind into brightness within that focal point, if we're focusing on an object like the breath. On the other hand, when it gets too bright, too sharp, too agitated, too excited, then it needs to relax. And so we need to relax that mind, and we have to learn how to do that. What does that mean? And not just within one particular way that that appears, but in many, many different ways that that appears. Tibetan Master Longchenpa said, described this clear, bright mind as infinitely pervasive, with no division into inside or outside. Without boundaries, it's free of the elaborations of any conceptual framework. But being free of any conceptual framework, it can hold a conceptual framework because it's free. Since the true nature of all things is equal, there's not a single thing that does not abide within that equalness, that equality. And because of that equality, some things can appear as high and some things can appear as low. Some things can be bright and some things can be dark. All things return to this one ultimate source that we speak of as Buddha nature, as emptiness, as mind, as luminous awareness. And in two, there is no duality. There is no intrinsic division into right and wrong. There is no conflict. Somebody asked the question about what does it mean to practice Buddhism if you also practice another faith. Buddhism has no problem with that because Buddhism, what we recognize is there is no conflict in the world until we create one. Conflict doesn't exist apart from the mind. But if that's true, then why is there so much pain and sorrow? Why, as the Buddha said, is the house on fire? The poem goes on to say, when no thought arises, the whole is fully revealed. If the six organs, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, move even a little, then it's obstructed by clouds. If you cut off your ignorance, your ailment increases. If you look for the truth, this is also incorrect. When no thought arises, the whole is fully revealed. Well, then what does that mean about when thoughts do arise? Well, in the beginning of practice, they seem to have the capacity to obscure our mind. Their thoughts seem to cause our mind to become agitated, to become dull, to become distracted, to create confusion. And because it appears to us that way, and we have that experience, we practice releasing our grasp of those thoughts so that we can begin to approach this very natural state of mind in which no thought arises. And so that we can begin to see that the thoughts themselves have never been the problem. They don't have any inherent ability to excite or to dull, to agitate, to upset us, or to make us happy. But in order to really see that clearly, we have to let all of that restlessness, that incessant movement that is happening within us, naturally and with effort, come to rest. Natural because that's the basic state of our being. We have to apply effort because we have such a deep and long-standing habit of moving, of restlessness, of agitation, of constantly moving forward, moving somewhere. The mind moves. Thoughts arise, and those thoughts lead to desires, and those desires seem to carry meaning. What does what we want mean to us? And that leads to attachments, and attachments leads to conflicts and disappointment and dissatisfaction. And that leads to more thoughts arising, more desires, more meaning. This is the cycle that we speak of as samsara. And in the midst of it, we look at it, and it seems like there's just objectively existing, self-standing, autonomous multitudes of things. We don't see mind's active involvement in creating the image, the sound, the taste, the touch, the meaning. We don't see that. And because we don't see that, the object that seems to be self-standing and objective appears just like that. Now, most, reasonably thinking people know that we bring something into our experiences, right? Know that in some ways we influence, we bring some bias into what we're experiencing. But do we really know that? Or how do we know that? How clearly do we know that? Are we able to see it happening? Are we able to understand how that arises? The Buddha said that is extremely important, because if suffering, dukkha, our delusion is likened to an illness, and we want to heal ourselves from that illness, we have to really understand the inner workings of the illness. Understanding the machinations of the illness, though, is not enough. You can be sick and spend hours on the internet or in the doctor's office learning everything you can about the illness and still be ill, right? We actually have to apply some healing medicine. And so we can know that we bring something to everything. We can know that our minds are not clear, that they have prejudice. We can know that we're attached to something. We can recognize that our minds are distracted, and it would be so much better if there was more mindfulness. And we may not go beyond just knowing those things. And that's what practice is about. Ultimately, it's not a matter of thinking or not thinking. When thoughts arise from a deluded mind, then the world that is created through those thoughts is deluded. Appears deluded. The thoughts themselves are not deluded. We can think of the thought as just energy that takes a particular form, right? It's like energy that we throw a certain set of clothes onto, right? So they appear in a certain way. Some appear very humble, some appear all dressed up. Some seem very noble, some seem very mean. But the nature, the essence, the blood and guts of those thoughts are all the same. They have no self. And so that's why in Zazen it's so important to practice not deluding our deluded thoughts. So when thoughts arise, anger, sadness, remembering, anticipating, anxiousness, dullness, the whole world arises one by one, sort of like Noah's Ark, you know. All of the different life forms, all the creatures appear. And we may recognize as practitioners, we may be able to recognize, oh, this is based in a false view, this is based in attachment. We know that. But in Zazen, we're trying to practice in a much more direct way and to see that deluded thought and not delude it in our mind, which is what happens when we begin to seize upon it and discriminate, differentiate, elevate it as high, denigrate it as low. Turn it into a weapon. Enshrine it as something spiritual. And so to allow our Zazen to be so utterly simple, unadorned, unornamented, which is a hard thing to trust, right? Because we like things that have lots of glitter and and so he says, if you cut off your ignorance, your ailment will increase, right? Because when we try to cut off our delusion or cut off our attachments, we're just going to war against ourselves. We're trying to extricate some aspect of ourselves. What would you do with it? On the other hand, if we go looking for the truth, we're also in the wrong, because what is truth? Is it a thing? Do we already have an idea of it? Will we know when we see it? When you find it, what will you do? Put it in a box? Master Dogen said, all Buddhas who individually transmit inconceivable Dharma, actualizing unsurpassable complete enlightenment, have a wondrous art, supreme and unconditioned, uncontrived. Receptive samadhi is its mark, is its sign. Only Buddhas transmit it to Buddhas without veering off. Sitting upright, practicing Zen, this is the authentic gate to free yourself in the unconfined realm of this samadhi. Although it is abundant in each person, it is not actualized without practice, and it is not experienced without realization. Although it's abundant in each person, it's not actualized, it's not made real without practice, and it's not experienced without realization. That realization is when that which is a direct experience, non-conceptual, an encounter with the ground of being, with our self-nature, which is unconditioned and supreme, comes into our awareness. And so Dogen speaks of receptive samadhi, concentration, which is receptive, which is very, very key here, right? Because many people think that practice is about just achieving a calm mind that is without thought, because it feels good and it feels peaceful, and we think this must be it. But then what happens to that calm and peaceful state? It comes apart. You get off the cushion, your mind becomes distracted, or maybe you don't even have to get off the cushion. Just a moment later, you become distracted, and that calmness is now agitated. So that peace is now not peaceful anymore. So that, the Buddha realized, and we must realize, cannot be the liberation that Buddha is teaching, because it's not liberating. It's impermanent. And so just getting to a place of quietness and stillness is important, but it's not yet really freeing ourselves. Dogen says, all Buddhas continuously abide in this Dharma, in this mind, and do not leave traces of consciousness where they are. Sentient beings continuously move about in this Dharma, but where they are is not clear in their consciousness yet. So Buddhas, enlightened beings, move around in it and don't leave traces of their consciousness. You know, that's sort of like what self-clinging, what the ego does, is constantly leaving like breadcrumbs, you know. And sometimes they're not breadcrumbs, they're boulders. They're buildings collapse, they're guns firing, they're sorrows magnified. And so that to practice selflessness is to try and not leave oneself behind, but only to create good. If you leave anything behind, let it be good. And so if we want to be free of conflict and strife, we actually have to practice being free of conflict and strife. If we want to bring peace into the world, we have to actually cultivate and bring forth peace within ourselves. There's nothing theoretical about this, nothing abstract. There's, in a sense, nothing delayed. You know, the whole sort of process to goal mentality is that we'll suck it up and delay gratification, right, until it comes, because it's going to come. And we'll get our degree or our certificate or our happiness or our enlightenment or our, you fill in the blank. And in a sense, we do have to learn not so much how to delay gratification, but just how to be patient and abide within the present moment, because that's the only true thing. And sometimes you're not going to like it. It's not going to appear in the way that you would like. In fact, that's going to happen a whole lot. And that's probably not new to you. And so how do you manifest peace now? How do you manifest not being in conflict and strife right in that moment? That's powerful. That's beginning to see what true freedom is, when it's no longer dependent on particular designs of circumstances that I have designed, what I need in order to have the life I want, but I can't ever get it together. I can't ever get it all to work. The example is we could try and cover the whole world, which is filled with thorns, with leather, or you could just put shoes on. In other words, we can continue to try and control things around us, or we can just begin to understand ourselves. So this student asked Master Yunmen, wanted to ask a question. The light serenely shines over the universe, Yunmen said. Isn't that the poem of Changcho? And she said, yes, it is. Yunmen says, you have missed it. Now, she knew it was a poem of Changcho. Yunmen knew it was the poem of Changcho. And so the question is, why has the student missed it? Why did Yunmen interrupt her and ask a question that he already knew the answer to, and he knew she knew the answer to, so that he could say, you've missed it? The teacher is pointing to the urgency, the imperative. It's like in that moment he was calling out, interrupting, saying, wait a minute, you're dying. Where's your mind? And calling out, you're alive. Don't squander your life. Now, what was your question? How did she miss it? And so we speak of a special transmission outside the sutras that can't be described, defined, contained, given through language. The metaphor of a finger pointing to the moon. The moon is enlightenment, but we mistake the finger. We get caught up in the finger. The moment you open your mouth, it's already been lost, Wu Men says. Do not place a head on top of the one you already have. If you see the Buddha, kill the Buddha. What are all of these teachings communicating? What are they saying? How do we make this our own? And what does that mean? It doesn't mean to take something and appropriate it for ourselves, sort of redesign it, refashion it into a likeness of ourself. But it's not abstract. It's not theoretical. It's not something out there. These koans, though these dialogues happened hundreds and hundreds of years ago, when the student takes it up, it has to be about right now. It's not about Yun Men. It's not about this student. It's about the student. How do we make something our own? And so we talk about having faith. We have to have some measure of faith, just enough to come into the door, just enough to take this seat, just enough to turn towards your breath. And then in that faith, we begin to verify. We begin to find out for ourselves what is true and what is not true. And in that way, and we discover that through our own direct experience. And so then the faith is verified through your own experience. You may not even understand it yet. You may not know or be able to really understand or put into any kind of a particular context of what that experience is, but there's a sense that it is true. And if you question that and say, well, that doesn't make sense, it might not make sense. When I first encountered the Dharma and I thought, this is true, if somebody had asked, how do you know? I would have said, I don't know. I don't know how I know that. Prove it to me. I can't. There was just a sense. Now, was that true? It seems to be for me. Could it have been false? Possibly. And so that's why just stopping there is not enough. I had to begin practicing. It seems true. I feel like this is true. Let me find out. And of course, I wasn't really thinking about it that way. But that is the way it is. And that's how it becomes our own. So when Yun Men says you have missed it, what did she miss? We can understand how attachments bind and confine and create suffering all the while we're still attaching. We can believe in liberation while we're still perpetuating samsara. We can have faith in selflessness while we're still actively creating a self. We can know that meditation would be very valuable in our lives and not meditate. And so in a sense, this is where we have to close the gap between what we know or what we sense or what we trust is true and what we're actually doing. It's harmonizing. Inner and outer, as Dogen said. Time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. How do we lose opportunities? Having been given this precious human life, if we can understand that our lives are more than just acquiring and storing possessions or accumulating titles and degrees or wealth or recognition or lots of fond memories, all of which are fine in and of themselves. But if we have understood that those things do not and cannot give us what we ultimately seek, if knowing all that and we do not enter, that's how we lose an opportunity. The student here answered honestly, and she answered correctly. It is the poem of Changchun. What did she miss? Master Dogen says, just forget yourself for now and practice inwardly. This is one with the thought of enlightenment, with bodhicitta. So really reflect on what he's saying, that when we practice, turning our attention into our practice and let go of what we're holding on to, let go of what we cling to as myself, as me, as what is mine. That in that moment of practice, that we are coming into unity, we are moving closer to, into alignment with enlightenment itself. When a notion of self arises, Dogen says, sit quietly and contemplate it. Is there a real basis inside or outside your body right now for that self? Where does it reside? Your body has hair and skin that you've inherited from your parents. From beginning to end, a drop of blood or lymph is empty. None of these are yourself. What about mind or thought or awareness or knowledge? Or your breath coming in and out, which seems to tie your whole lifetime together? What is all of this, after all? None of these are self either. And so how could you be attached to any of them? You figure there is a self where there is no self. You attach to birth where there is no birth. You do not practice the Buddha way, which should be practiced. You do not cut off the worldly mind, the world of attachments and desires and distractedness, which should be cut off. Avoiding the true teaching and pursuing the groundless teaching, how could you not be mistaken? So clearly Dogen is speaking to his students which he clearly has faith are, have already dedicated themselves to the path. For some of you, for many of you, that may not be clear at all, which is fine. But to hear what he's saying more broadly, that whether we're on a path or not, whether we're on a different path, time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. Life and death are of supreme importance. We are having an impact on the world every day. We are having our own experience of this life, which is fleeting. This path is not ultimately about information or knowledge or even truth. There is a person who is close to you who has a perfectly endowed, enlightened mind, which is unhindered and boundless and compassionate. They have been given, this person who is close to you has been given the gift of the body of a Buddha, of possessing Buddha mind, possessing Buddha wisdom. And because that person has arrived here in this hall, or has arrived here from where you sit, the path is already present. It's stirring. There is already disruption in place. A call has been sent out. Is there someone who will respond? Responding is the life of a student. When you wake up in the morning, as you get dressed, as you make a meal, as you engage a task, as you do your meditation. But everybody does those things. How is it different for someone who is responding to the call? How is it different for someone who has not missed it? Be that person and find out. Dogen says, the body already is not you. Life moves through days and months and is hard to stop even for a moment. When we try to ask where our youth is gone, there are no traces. When we observe carefully, we see that there are so many things from the past that we will never meet again. The red heart does not stop. It seems to come and go, piece by piece by piece. The world is ablaze with unexamined minds. And yet we have great power. Those two together create a very, very dangerous precariousness. When the mind is unexamined, the heart will be constricted. The eyes will be cloudy. The world will be a very confusing place. It'll be hard not to just spin in blaming and blaming and blaming. The Bodhisattva does not wait. Does not wait for enlightenment. Does not wait for the heart to open. Does not wait for the mind to settle. The Bodhisattva does not wait to be rescued, to be saved, to be comforted, to be tucked into bed. The Bodhisattva has a clarity that this life, this precious life, is a gift. And it's a gift, it becomes a gift when we illuminate it and give it away. The red heart is here and now. What will you do with this gift? What are you doing? It's not a future tense kind of thing. It's a here and now kind of thing. It's an everyday wake up and wonder kind of thing. It's a going to bed at night reflecting kind of thing. And that can seem like a lot of work. Like being mindful can seem just like an awful lot of work. Like it's a burden to be alert, to be awake, to be alive. And so, for the good of our lives and for the good of all of those in the midst and to come, my wish is that we would all be on a true path with sincerity, with that red heart. Because then we see. The Buddha once said, if people could see the world that the way he did, could understand the importance of generosity the way he understood it, he said no one would ever sit down to a meal without making sure that everyone around them was already eating. It's like the view of the Bodhisattva. The more we understand that it does not have to be a struggle, the more difficult it is to be complacent to the struggle. And the more we naturally want others, in any way possible, to be alleviated of that struggle.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.